One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
We'll be right back. Well, there we are, an intriguing electronic start to Graham's latest show. We are, of course, talking about Sound and Director's Vision, Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision. Graham, welcome back to your show. I need this to say, the first time, of course, today that you are welcoming a guest, your first ever guest on Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting. Exciting, and it ties in with what we've just heard.
Yes, I'm really welcome, Roger. Really, really good to see you.
Well, it's Roger Lim, of course, in case people are wondering, who can this Roger be? The awesomely talented Roger Lim, BBC Radiophonic Workshop's finest, and indeed the last time I was privileged to work with Roger, thanks to yourself, Graham, way back in the 80s. He'd forgotten all about me. It's understandable. I can go with that. Graham,
I remember it well, but you just had to trigger that one memory, and that once you mentioned the background, it all came flooding back.
Like Vietnam, Roger. Never mind. We'll go into a different line entirely. Graham, share with us. We're reaching that time in your career where clearly the vitality of connecting with Roger Lim was going to happen to yourself. Just share the story. How did he come into your life?
Well, so in the early 80s, 1982, I started my career as a director at the BBC, and I did some Angels, the drama series called Angels, which was then followed by, how I got this, I've no idea, a play for BBC Two, and the producer was Andre Molyneux, and it was a very, very interesting, strange play about racism. And it was a story about an old man in Bedsit Land in Notting Hill Gate area, and Sam, who was a black man in his 40s, who was going to, he was studying law, but he was meanwhile working as a ticket collector on the London Underground. And I said to Andre, when we made the play, I really would love a jazz score for this, if you can afford to do it. And she said, I know the very man for you to meet, which was Roger Lim. And she mentioned Roger Lim. And she said, and you'll meet him at the Radiophonic Workshops. And she arranged that meeting. And I thought, well, I don't want plinkety plonk. I don't want electronic music. I want a jazz score. But anyway, when I met Roger, who I hope he agrees, but we got on very well straight away. And I was really excited. I love music, and I'm now going to work with the composer. It was fantastic. And I said to him, I really was looking forward to a jazz score of some sort. A tenor sax and alto sax is what I had in my mind, to speak for each of the men, you know, tenor sax for Sam, the black guy, and an alto sax for this elderly gentleman. And he took me up on that. Over to you, Roger. It was extraordinary.
Well, it was an interesting project. I'd always been playing jazz ever since school days, really, and I've been a jazz fan. And jazz and music has always been not just in the background of my life, but often to the foreground of my life. So I joined the BBC in the sort of mid-60s or so, early 60s. But and I worked in various jobs, a studio manager. I was even a newsreader and a TV announcer, voiceovers and all that sort of stuff. This is BBC One. That was my catchphrase. and eventually I discovered the Radiophonic Workshop, and I had an attachment there and realized that all my sort of musical instincts could be nurtured in a place like that, where I would be called upon to provide all sorts of different music, but probably approaching music from an electronic music point of view, because the Radiophonic Workshop was an electronic music studio. But I had all this jazz in my backpack, and it didn't take long for me to find all sorts of reasons and to bring it out of the backpack and put it as part of the output of the Radiophonic Workshop. Of course, I had to be, when I say careful, I mean, it was radiophonic music, and you know, it was not meant, designed to be a place where you could just drop in and put some jazz musicians together and come out with something. So, in other words, people often ask me, what exactly is radiophonic music? Well, what is the definition of it? And I would say, well, it's a bit like sort of Humpty Dumpty said, you know, it means whatever I want it to mean at the time. So with that excuse, I sort of launched into all sorts of different scores using all sorts of different instruments. And I think with the score I did for The Hope and the Glory, which was Graham's film, I don't think that was my first venture into jazz, but it was certainly a very memorable one. And although I haven't had a chance to listen to the score recently, I do remember we had saxophone player, at least perhaps two saxophone players, together with an electronic backing. And I can't, as I say, I can't remember the details, but I remember doing it, and I remember the film, and I remember meeting Graham, of course, for the first time. I had worked with Andre Molyneux before on a couple of films with a certain amount of success, and that's probably why she pushed me in the direction of Graham, or did she push Graham in the direction of me? I can't quite put. But that's really how it came about.
It was really interesting because I was absolutely in awe of this wonderful building. You thought I was going to say wonderful man then, but he is a wonderful man. And I went to the Radiophonic Workshop in Maida Vale, this lovely old, I don't know, was it an old long Victorian low building with three or four studios, big.
Well, that's right. I mean, we could talk a long time about the building itself. It was a remarkable building. It was built probably 20s and 30s. It's got a certain amount of more decorative deco about it. But and it was built originally as a skating rink. Now, ice skating or roller skating, not quite sure. But I once worked with a fine old, wonderful old actor there who came in to do some voiceovers for me, and he said, "Oh, I remember coming here with my wife in 1929. We did roller skating." It must have been roller skating. I think probably in the 30s. I think the BBC took it over. They had another building next door in a convent or something. Like BBC at that time were taking over buildings and using them for studio premises, and that is how Maida Vale Studios, this rather remarkable long building, came into operation as a BBC studio complex. Of course, it's now come full circle, and the BBC are now moving away from it. They had plans, of course, to get rid of the building, perhaps sell it, or perhaps destroy it and sell the site, but it's achieved listed status. So the BBC are now left with a sort of white elephant, a rather pretty white elephant, but something they didn't really need. So that's the history of the studios. And the Radiophonic Workshop was established there in the very beginning. Well, not at the very beginning, but almost in the second week, and was there for the entire length of the workshop. And I was there for 20 years, and I think it had been going at least 10, 15 years before I'd got there.
Gosh.
Important that next year we have the centenary of the BBC as the British Broadcasting Company when it was launched in 1922, 5 years, of course, before it became the British Broadcasting Corporation. So we'll stick around for that, I'm sure.
Oh, well, I'm
glad you mentioned that because I'd completely forgotten. I knew it was the British Broadcasting Company and I knew it was the early 1920s, but I'd completely forgotten. Thank you for reminding me.
Graham, we started this show off by listening to, as I say, the alternate version of Roger's Suite for Caves of Androzani, because that's certainly one of the key elements. How did he come onto your radar in terms of this is a must-go-to composer? I mean, he's done Nyssa's theme, he's done so much wonderful work for Doctor Who, etc. It's time for him to be brought on board, because let's face it, John Lennon and Paul McCartney weren't available for a day in the life.
Well, I didn't really want a day in the life. So in the following year, or was it the same in 1983? Probably the same year. I was then offered, as you just said, my first Doctor Who story. I was really excited because it was going to be action-adventure. But the programme was quite a tired programme by then and, you know, was being seen off the premises, really. They were trying to get rid of it, I think. And John Nathan Turner was struggling, you know, to really reinvent it all the time and keep it exciting as much as he could. So when it came to my turn to do Doctor Who, I knew now that Roger Lynn was part of the Radiophonic Workshop and I knew that they did all the music for all the Doctor Who's. So I asked John, you know, could we make sure that Roger was the man who, because we got on and I really would like to have him as my composer for that, or the, not my composer, but the composer for that story. And it was arranged, it worked out beautifully. And Roger was put onto the programme, attached to the programme, and we went and met. And I always remember the first meeting we had for Doctor Who. I said to him, when you see this programme, I do not like electronic music, Roger. I hadn't really got to know Kraftwerk by then. because I've changed my mind. But I said to him, I really don't like electronic music. And he said, well, you've come to the wrong place because that's what we do. And I said, okay. But when you see it, it's a new Star Wars has started and Raiders of the Lost Ark. It needed a big orchestral sound. Well, we couldn't really afford an orchestra to do this. But anyway, Roger took on board my my angst, I suppose, and we got a fantastic. He created a fantastic, strange, wonderful. It was electronic, but it was also synthesized sounds, orchestral sounds, because it needs to be kind of Phantom of the Opera kind of music. And that's what I think we got, Roger.
Well, first of all, I had worked on several Doctor Who stories before that with varying degrees of success, shall we say. Some of the scores were I was quite pleased with. Some didn't quite measure up to my hopes, but they were all pretty good stuff and they were used. But a lot, as a composer, you depend a lot on your director. And you depend, the director doesn't have to be a musician. In fact, it can be a bit of a disadvantage. I can tell you some stories about directors who wanted to have a direct musical input to their program. But Graham, although he was a music fan and knew what he wanted music to do, he was able to express it to me in an enthusiastic way. That's enthusiasm is a word we always associate with Graham. But he was able to put it across to me what exactly he wanted. Well, we hit it off. And I mean, it was a gamble, really. It wasn't automatically sort of wonderful world at first sight. I mean, he gave me a thorough briefing and he said, I'm going to come back in a few days and see how you're getting on. So it was some trepidation that I played him some of the themes and some of the ideas that I were having. But fortunately, from the very beginning, he was enthusiastic, which helped to give me, shall we say, impetus and a positive feeling about working on the rest of the episodes.
Is this one of the reasons, Roger, briefly, why you actually have titled one of the tracks in, of course, the soundtrack album of Caves of Androzani? Do you think I'm mad? Was that a kind of deliberate sort of dig of that sort of point? Do you think I'm mad?
Thank you.
Let me think. You're talking about the compilation album that came
indeed,
out?
Indeed, yes.
And I was not necessarily across the naming of the cube. A similar thing has recently happened. I did it around about the same time as I was working for Graham. I worked on another notable series called The Box of Delights, which from which the music was also presented fairly recently as an album. And some of the titles there, I raised my eyebrows because I it became a little bit of a joke among some people. On the other hand, at least they're talking about it. I would rather them have a joke about it than not mention it at all.
Roger, I'm sure back in the day, Ludwig and Johannes and probably even Wolfgang would have actually loved to have had the title Morgus Caput or Milk of the Queen Bat. I mean, these are Wagnerian in terms of just titles alone.
I remember the album coming out. I remember wondering at some of the titles. But I don't want to brain on Graham's Parade, but I've been rather overtaken in the last year by this Box of Delights album because I've been involved in all sorts of things in relation to that, radio interviews and some...
It's an outstanding album, Roger.
I'm very pleased with it. And I was using a lot of conventional musical instruments. Now, when it came to the shows I did with Graham, I was entirely there in my electronic music studio. On the other hand, I did have some, shall we say, samples of real instruments, mainly percussion instruments.
Yes.
And bells and chanting voices.
Yes.
Which blended in carefully but beautifully with some of the electronic synth music that I was coming up with as well. So it was a bit of a sort of a potpourri. That's a good word, isn't it? Or is it two words? Oh, no, it's at least two anyway. But it seemed to work very nicely, and Graham was enthusiastic, and more importantly, I think John Nathan Turner quite enjoyed it too.
Yes, I agree. What was really interesting was I remember the Sharaz Jek theme. There was a Sharaz Jek was this kind of, well, he was a very badly scarred man, like the Phantom of the Opera, and he wore a Zulu kind of mask, a Zulu warrior mask. excuse me. And I think Roger, that influenced Roger to use sort of African Zulu tribal drums and strange synth sounds. And there was a sort of Jaws type string stab in it.
Yes, I remember that one. Yes, I was quite pleased with the way that worked.
Thank you.
It was brilliant. Whenever Shara's Jet was alone in his den, prowling around his electronic equipment, etc., thinking about working out what he was going to do next, there was this fantastic, strange Zulu-style mute. It was extraordinary. A tribal warrior. It was really, really exciting. I'm not saying Doctor Who didn't have any great music. Of course it did. But I think Roger's music changed. Well, it was a new benchmark, and I think it had to go forward from there onwards in a slightly different way. And of course, in the last new series, the music's completely orchestral and huge and vast and whatever.
You got your way at the end, Graham, obviously. You got your way in the end. You'd have that orchestral body coming in there.
Well, we got there in the end, but Roger did a with his constraints of what he could afford to use and what he had, it was stunning. There was some fantastic music. And then the music of the chase across the sand dunes, etc., in the last episode, really exciting, thrilling music. It was really, really, really good and innovative and exciting.
It was, and I think the cue that you've just built up to, the when the Doctor changes from one Doctor, from Peter Davison to Colin Baker, that is often played, and people quite often Doctor Who enthusiasts send me letters or emails when they can find me, and they say I'm always moved to tears when I hear that music, and I must say
that's lush.
It worked out very, very well, and this was building up, of course, to the Beatles bit. What was the name of the track again?
A Day in the Life.
A Day in the Life. Now, in fact, Graham, I think you did refer to A Day in the Life. You said, I don't want it, but I want that sort of build-up that A Day in the Life does, and then it's suddenly released with a big thud.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you asked for, and I think that's what you got, and it seemed to work in that sort of way. Probably the Beatles weren't the first people to do that, but they did the most famous version of that sort of cue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was good. It was. I wanted Peter Davison's character, Doctor Who, to go out with a proper bang. You know, you remembered it very well, and I think you do.
Well, we'll be listening, obviously, to not just Sound and Director's Vision with Graham Harper, but also a special guest on this particular episode, Roger Lim, composer extraordinaire. We've talked about his awesome work with respect to Caves of Androzani. And, of course, I have to give a mention to Nyssa's theme, which I still thought from The Keeper of Traken was outstanding, Roger. Personal favourite.
Well, thank you very much. At about that set time, when I composed Nyssa's theme, one of my sons was learning some simple pieces by Bartok. Bartok piano pieces for kids, and they're very, very simple. And I use that as a sort of, well, I didn't pinch it, but I pinched the idea of a little simple two-part thing, not too straightforward a theme, a little theme that goes around a little bit, but nevertheless it could be very easily played. So that's where I got the idea from. That's where the seed of the idea for Nyssa's theme came from.
And I think, Graham, you wouldn't mind if we actually squeezed in a little bit of Nyssa's theme just to kind of act as a bridge at this moment.
Well, she was in my episode, so yes.
Onwards we go. Graham, Revelation of the Daleks, of course, your next Doctor Who episode, which of course needs the music of our special guest, Roger Lim, today. We'll be wrapping up the whole programme with it, the whole suite for Revelation of the Daleks. Talk us through this.
So the next year, John Nathan Turner asked me if I'd come back to do another story, but now with Colin Baker as the new Doctor Who. So I didn't do the first episodes, but I did. I was offered a block, a two-part story in the next series, as it were, with Colin. And this was a really interesting, strange, well, they all are, but this was a strange, weird story about, well, there was an aspect of
a DJ in a morgue, Graham. Let's face it. I've talked about this for 30-odd years. A disc jockey in a morgue. Unbelievable. It's like some of our best listeners back in the days of Dulwich Hospital Radio. Unbelievable.
And we had Alexei Sale as our DJ, which was even more brilliant. It's a totally different story. It wasn't the action-adventure of Caves of Androzani. This was more not a melodrama. It was a strange, creepy... a story about cryogenic chambers and the dead, really. And there was a DJ who played music to the dead. It was really weird and strange.
Ideal pandemic viewing, I would have thought.
Yes. You'd end up in cryogenic chambers. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? So again, Roger luckily was available, and we were joined together again. And this was a totally different story. This was it required a totally different feel to it altogether. And again, Roger created a fantastic, exciting musical score to it. But it was totally different to Caves of Androzani. Do you remember that, Roger? Do you remember doing it?
Oh yes, although Androzani, I think, probably is perhaps the best known and the most widely, acknowledged. The Revelation of the Daleks was equally as challenging, equally as rewarding. And I do listen occasionally to the music and think, wow, that's, I remember doing that. To me, yes, sure, it was set in a morgue with some weird people around. What was the name of the actor who played the chief mortician? Clive Swift. That's right. And he was wonderfully creepy with his strange assistant as well. And then of course there was the DJ as well. I I don't really take on much of the story. I take on the scenes, I think it was. This is what it was. And we haven't even mentioned the Bleeding Daleks yet. I mean, they were a central part of the story as well, yeah, of course. And then there was this a side story about two soldiers who had mercenaries had come back from somewhere else. But what it seemed to me was there was less organic music in that than there was in Caves of Androzani. It was almost entirely electronic, with a lot of harsh rasping sounds, which I thought coincided well with the fact that we were dealing with harsh creatures like the old Daleks, and they didn't invite organic sort of music. They invited harsh electronic music, and the way they act and the way they deal with situations. So that's why I came up with that particular flavored score, I think.
There was some lovely use of bells, and it was creepy. That's what I remember, creepy and question marks. Each piece of music seemed to be a question mark. It was quite odd and interesting. I really, really liked it, and very different, because there was not that race against time which Caves of Androzani had, and yet it was a race against time, you know, to defeat Davros and his horrible Daleks, etc. What I liked was you had sort of themes for Orsini. Do you remember the swashbuckling?
William Gaunt's character.
Also, yeah, I'm trying to think what I'm saying here. What's the kind of character he was? Pancho Sanchez.
Oh, that's right. He was Pancho to Bill Gaunt's sort of the
Man famous of La Mancha.
That's what we're trying to say.
Oh, dear. Write the whole script for us, I think.
I have to get the script and read it. There was
Don
some
Quixote
lovely
is the word you're looking for. Don Quixote.
Don Quixote.
Oh,
Quixote,
thank
of course,
goodness,
yeah,
we've got somebody who knows
Sancho Panda, yeah.
Yes, it was. There was lovely themes referring to each of these characters, which were really interesting and nice. And they were oddball characters, all coming together to fight against this electronic madman, etc.
Here's an interesting sideline to that story. I think I've told you that, Graham, this story. 6 months later, I was relaxing in a taverna in Corfu, and on the next table was Bill Gaunt, William Gaunt. And I leant over and said, "Here's a coincidence," I said. "I spent the whole of last February setting you to music." He said, "I loved all that music." And we had a long chat and a gossip, and we talked a lot about Graham and how enthusiastic we were towards his direction and everything like that. We had a very pleasant and mellow evening discussing the old, the revelation of the Daleks.
Oh, isn't that funny? That's brilliant.
We're progressing onwards, Graham, as ever. Time is of the essence. Any other thoughts or questions you'd like to put to Roger? Of course, legend now, because he is your first ever guest on Sound and Director's Vision.
Yes, I'm really pleased to have you, Roger, too. So what after when Doctor Who really died away and disappeared for 15, 20 years, what were you doing after that? I know you didn't spend your whole life doing Doctor Who, but what did the Radiophonic Workshop then carry on doing? What did you specifically do?
Well, I did the same sort of thing I was doing before Doctor Who arrived in our in-tray, I suppose. Although I have to say, I mean, I left the workshop, I was offered early retirement in 94, I think, something like that. So I've now been retired longer than I was at the Radiophonic Workshop, which is some sort of record, I'm not quite sure. But the workshop was always under pressure in the 90s, I think. The sort of clientele that we had, first of all, we were in the vanguard of electronic music and setting up electronic music studios. But from 1990 onwards, lots of very talented kids could set up on their own in their own studios at home. And even some of them were getting commissioned by the producers of Doctor Who. I think John Nathan Turner had left by then, but the writing was on the wall for us. But we had the whole place, the whole scene sewn up until about 1990. I worked on all sorts of, I mean, Doctor Who was a significant part of my output, but I've already mentioned The Box of Delights and loads of other films that I did, some drama, some kids' stuff. I wrote a whole lot of kids' stuff, particularly during the 70s and 80s. and even on into the 90s. I'm trying to think of some useful statistics, but I can't at the moment.
Did you actually also play to audiences? Did you go out and do gigs?
Yes. First of all that through that time I was at the workshop, I was doing gigs, but they were jazz gigs, not electronic music.
All right.
Of course. But as far as electronic music gigs is concerned, well, in 2009, the four of us who had been at the workshop realized that there was a sort of what I call a residual interest in the work of the workshop, you know, because loads of people in their 30s and 40s had been brought up as kids seeing Radiophonic Workshop on the screen or hear it mentioned on the radio. And there was a fan base waiting to be exploited, if you like.
Oh,
and so we formed a band and we did a big successful concert at London's Roundhouse, presenting a lot of stuff we'd done before, including, a Doctor Who is our big finish. Since then, we've done 40 or 50 gigs up and down the country and in Europe as well. Germany particularly, they like us there. And we did Glastonbury. We've done a whole series of British festivals. Of course, it's all gone very quiet over the last year because of the pandemic, but we're still hoping to get the band on the road again. And that's what we've set our minds towards doing. So, gigs, but only those were the electronic gigs. I'm still doing jazz gigs. In fact, one came in yesterday for May the 1st.
Oh, great. We should know where that is. What instruments did you take? Are they synthesizers when you're doing the electronic concerts?
Yes, I would guess so. But of course, I'm talking to you now via my little MacBook laptop, and a lot of the stuff, I mean, my laptop is on the stage with me, together with keyboards such as these I've got here, for example. There we are.
All right, yeah.
Et cetera. Yeah. So in fact, on stage, there are perhaps four or five of us, each with our own little radiophonic workshop, but all tied up together to a central hub. And the music is, there's loads of films of our concerts on YouTube. All you got to do is look up Radiophonic Workshop at Glastonbury or at the Blue Dot Festival and things like that. You can see us at work if you want.